From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. Today, we heard from police in Highland Park, Illinois, that the person of interest in yesterday's mass shooting at the 4th of July parade planned the attack for weeks, bought his gun legally, and had a disturbing online presence that glorified mass violence. Again, that was according to police. Police apprehended Robert Bobby Cremo III, a 21-year-old who lived in the nearby area of Highwood, yesterday, next to the car he'd borrowed from his mom, wearing women's clothing, which police said was an attempt to disguise himself. And that's the only time in this segment that we're going to be mentioning his name. We want to know, what can we learn from his online presence? Ben Collins covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC News. He immediately found the young man's online trail and joins us now. Ben, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So this is what you do, search for people who could be extremists. It takes you to some pretty sordid, violent rabbit holes. But how did you find this person? Where'd you look? What'd you find?
Well, this guy was kind of a known entity in this space. There is a space of people on the internet who glorify and fetishize mass violence. And this was one of those people who was very involved in that. He had made music videos under the rapper name Awaken. And in those videos, he shot up schools, or he got into shootouts with the police. That's what his whole online identity was for. He had a Discord chat, which is basically like a message board devoted to him, where they talked about this sort of thing, where they talked about political nihilism, where they talked about nihilism in general. The idea, effectively, that the only way out of this sort of thing, through their lives, which they viewed to be incredibly difficult, was through mass shooting. And you see a lot of this on spaces like 4chan on the internet, but also smaller message boards that have popped up since then. This is a real dedicated community to this sort of what I would call doomerist thinking.
Well, look, when you say they, how many theys are there? People talk about a lone wolf if somebody's not associated with, let's say, Al-Qaeda. But is this a community?
Yeah, it's not correct to call a lone wolf at this point. They are loners who feel isolated in the real world because they don't have any people in their lives who will step up and give them some sort of real life community. Yeah. However, they do not have that sort of problem on the internet where these people who fetishize mass violence and mass murder will come together and they will talk about the previous successes in their eyes of mass killers. This has been happening since basically Columbine, but has accelerated since Dylann Roof, the Charleston shooter several years ago, because of the way the internet works. In these spaces, they call him Saint Roof. They view him as a messianic figure, and they view kill counts as statistics, as things to beat. They view these people together as effectively like deities. And that's what you see in these spaces online.
This is incredibly disturbing. Is this something you are obviously, you go down these rabbit holes, but is this something that authorities should be keeping an eye on? Or it sounds like it might be impossible. It sounds like there's too many.
It's really difficult. There are very specific rabbit holes. For example, that Discord chat that he had was, 70-something people. But there's a lot of overlap with larger forums. There's overlap with 4chan. He was a power user on basically a snuff website that was devoted to, beheading videos and things like that up until the very end, basically last week. So these people they have hyper-centralized spaces, but they also have more generalized spaces as well where they meet up and talk more vague, maybe politics, maybe general life stuff. That's really where those people are tracked. But the issue is they don't have a name. It's not like ISIS. It's not like Al-Qaeda or something. You can't just say, they're all a member of this group, and that's how it goes. They are decentralized, and they are very focused on remaining that way, too.
Well, I want to ask you on that note. I heard you say something very interesting last night. You said you found posts of, again, the person of interest in the July 4th parade shooting, who police say, bought the gun. They are alleging he carried this out, but still person of interest. But you say you saw posts of him at a Trump rally and wrapped in another post in a Trump banner, I think it was. But you cautioned at the time against concluding that means anything. Why? Remind us why.
Because in these spaces, everything is a joke to them. Everything is irony to them. And also, I would say in these communities, some of these people, some early on accelerationists, which is what this is accelerationism, the idea that society is not worth saving and that everything needs to be basically blown apart and, you know, brought back up from there. And some people don't even care about the bringing back up from there. They just want pure chaos. Those people viewed at one point, some of them, Donald Trump to be a tool to further their cause. And that may be how he viewed him. But a lot of people have moved on past Donald Trump in those spaces. So, you know, in 2021, he may have been a Donald Trump fan. He may have been an ironic Donald Trump fan back then. But you can't make that conclusion today that he did this of some political value when all of the signs point to the idea that he had been obsessed with mass murder, just like all of his compatriots in the internet.
Yeah. Ben Collins, who covers disinformation extremism for NBC News, you can go to NBCnews.com for his latest reporting, which, as always, Ben, is chilling. Thank you.
Thank you.
The abortion map in this country, post Roe v. Wade, is complicated. Some states have strengthened access to abortion. Some have let previously passed bans take effect. And some are working on new abortion bills. Georgia has a restrictive law, which is being challenged and now before a federal appeals court. Of course, Georgia is a key battleground state with critical races this year for governor and for U.S. senator. Let's talk now to Sam Greenglass, political reporter for WABE in Atlanta. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Scott.
So Georgia's abortion ban prohibits the procedure after 6 weeks of pregnancy. It is similar to laws in about a dozen other states. It barely passed, but never took effect. Why not?
So the law has basically been tied up in courts for the last couple of years. And where it's at right now is this federal appeals court here in Georgia had basically paused the proceedings waiting on this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. And now that the high court has ruled that abortion policy should be made by the states, it is very likely that this federal appeals court here in Georgia is going to rule within the next couple of weeks and very likely will rule that this restrictive abortion law can take effect here in Georgia.
Okay. In the meantime, there could be activity in the state courts, I gather. Georgia's state constitution has upheld the right to privacy, and abortion rights supporters might take a case to the state Supreme Court, which could make it, you know, pretty interesting or messy, however you think about it. But I want to ask you how this is playing out politically. The governor's race is a rematch between Brian Kemp, the Republican incumbent, and Stacey Abrams, who lost by a whisker. How is each candidate talking about this issue?
Well, I think Governor Kemp has the finest line to walk. He's the Republican incumbent, and he signed this restrictive abortion law back in 2019. And since then, in this moment post-Roe, there have been advocates within the Republican Party calling for an even stricter abortion law than the one that's already been passed. Kemp, though, is going to need to compete for as many swing voters as possible, given the really tight margins in this state. So, you know, he kind of has this tricky dance to make between, you know, basically what he's said so far is, I am proud of the law that we passed in 2019, and I want it to be enforced as quickly as possible. Democrats are very hopeful that this Roe v. Wade ruling will energize their voters. A recent NPR poll found that a majority of Americans are more likely to vote for a candidate who would restore abortion rights. And so we have heard Abrams and other Democrats up and down the ballot talking about this election as a referendum on abortion rights.
Of course, also on the ballot is, in the U.S. Senate race in Georgia, the Democratic incumbent Raphael Warnock. He's going up against Herschel Walker, a pro-Trump Republican who presents himself as staunchly anti-abortion. Where is that race, and how important is the abortion issue there?
So I actually had a chance to ask Herschel Walker about his abortion stance a couple of weeks ago before he won his primary handily. And he said that he sees no exception in his mind when it comes to abortion, and that seems to imply that he would support an even more restrictive law, perhaps at the federal level, should he take a seat in the U.S. Senate, that would not have carve-outs for rape or incest or health of the mother. Now, I think Republicans, including Walker, are counting on other issues to rise above abortion rights when voters who are maybe on the fence are deciding how to cast their ballot this fall. Remember, you know, we have high gas prices, inflation, grocery store bills are rising. And that is the type of topic that we see being emphasized again and again from Republicans, including Walker.
All right. And quickly, how tight are each of these races right now?
Well, Georgia is, I think it's pretty fair to say, one of the most competitive states in the country. Joe Biden won it by a very slim margin of just about 11,000 votes back in 2020. Mm. And so I think you will see lots of money and attention being directed to Georgia as, you know, one of the centers of the political universe in this country.
That's Sam Greenglass, political reporter for WABE in Atlanta. Sam, thanks again.
Thank you, Scott.
Last month saw a justifiable celebration of the 50th anniversary of Title IX, the 1972 37-word statute that declared that no one could be denied participation or be otherwise discriminated against on the basis of sex in any education program or activity that received federal dollars. Or, if you're spending tax dollars on a sports program for guys, you had to have the same sports program for girls. It was revolutionary. In 1971, the year before the law, there were just 300,000 girls playing high school sports in the U.S. Today, there are over 3.5 million. But today, we're going to look at how to go forward and fix what many see as Title IX's failures to bring equity to black girls. Tina Sloan Green has dedicated her career to leveling that playing field. She was the first black woman to play on the U.S. national field hockey team from 1969 to 73, went on to become the first black coach of a women's lacrosse team at Temple University, eventually co-founded the Black Women in Sports Foundation. Her daughter Tracy Green is the tennis coach at Harvard. And Tina still picks up a stick, as she did this past weekend. She's a goddess. Tina Sloan Green, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
Make this case that you and others see so clearly that young black girls have not benefited from Title IX in the way young white girls may have.
Well, I'm here at the Women's World Championship in Maryland. And when I walk into rooms, there's very few people that look like me. So the stats are out there.
Well, I'll give you one. You're at the Division I Women's Lacrosse Championship. Only 2.2% of Division I Women's Lacrosse players are black. For Division I swimmers, it's 2%. But it does get netty. You know, what might be directly Title IX and the amount of money that's being spent in schools on sports, and maybe there's also inequity in communities. What do you think is the cause?
Yeah, I can, you know, definitely use myself as an example. You know, I grew up in Philadelphia, a small black community. We didn't have any organized sports in school. I just happened to go to a school for academically talented girls. It was there that I was mentored and told to go to Westchester. And Westchester was a predominantly white state school. So many of my elementary school classmates never got the opportunity to participate in preppy sports like lacrosse, field hockey, and fencing. So a lot depends on opportunity. And opportunity, to me, has to be intentional because, you know, seeing is believing. Had I not been exposed, you know, to the sports of field hockey and lacrosse, I wouldn't be in the position I am now.
And again, to be clear, Title IX didn't say you had to have sports programs. It said if you had a sports program for guys, you had to have a sports program for girls. So that leaves us with school systems that, as you just said, yours didn't even have sports programs. It reminds me of Natasha Watley, the two-time Olympic medalist in softball, a Black woman. After the Olympics, she was talking to Black girls about her experience, and one young Black girl said, "Wow, that's amazing. What's softball?" So if you don't have it in the community, you don't even know what it is. I mean, how do you change this?
You have to believe that sport is good for everybody. The rich people know that. In their private schools, they make sure boys and girls are exposed to a variety of sports and activities in their communities, their playgrounds, and their parks. So if it's good for one, it's good for the other. We're exposing young people at an early age now. And I'm preaching pre-K through eighth grade. You know, I was a participant, but I'm also a coach. I'm also a professor. They're seeing it in real life.
So young women, white and Black, are seeing you, and it's changing their image of who can play lacrosse, who can be a coach. And you saw them. I mean, when you started coaching college lacrosse at Temple, you saw the neighborhood kids looking through the fence. And this is a largely Black neighborhood. And that might have been the first time they ever saw not just lacrosse, but saw a Black woman playing lacrosse. How do you transfer that sudden light bulb with a kid going, hey, this is a sport, I like this, a sport that was started by the way, people of color, Native Americans. A little kid seeing this, how do you take that energy and convert it into them actually playing it? Because many inner city schools can't afford to start lacrosse teams.
I think as a coach and a teacher, you have to be observant of your environment and the people that you're dealing with. And when I saw I wasn't fulfilling what I thought should be my mission, then I would go up to the president's office and say, listen, we need this. Because they're using us, they're using me as a way to satisfy Title IX.
Right.
But I see that, where's the program at Temple? How many people do you have here who are my color and come from my background? So when you start challenging things and you're not afraid to step up and step out, and you know, Vivian is another living legend. Yeah. And we weren't scared because we saw what was going on.
Well, we know at Temple you expanded the camps that were already there and went out and recruited in these communities that had been overlooked. And you included the children in the neighborhood who were looking through the fence. And we talked about how communities needed to get programs going to expose kids to sports like softball. But there are those who say, and one is Nina Chaudhry from the National Women's Law Center, who say, you know, it's got to be at schools because schools at least have access to these public dollars. Many communities are hurting right now. What do? Send people like yourself to public schools? How do you get the desire going in kids to play a sport they've never seen, which might spark a school to bring that sport into the school?
Well, I think this is the ideal time because of the social media. Like I'm old. I don't understand these. These young people now, they're walking around with their telephones. They understand the technology, social media. That's our biggest positive, innovative thing that we can use right now. And when women's sports start making money, like I'm here at this this championship, and I'm seeing on this beautiful hotels and the marketing and all this. There's money being made.
Yeah.
But who's making that money? Who's at the top? When I go into boardrooms, who's there? Very few Black women are at the top. A lot of white men.
You're saying start social media campaigns and use that as a way to expose kids to things that you and I both never saw. Kickball was like, right? The biggest deal. You know, I understand that you were spotted by a gym teacher who saw an athlete in you. It sounds like it's a combination of everything. It's being exposed to the sport, being exposed to the role models like yourself, having people like a gym teacher back you, having schools bring in programs to go beyond Title IX.
Right. And see success stories. And this is where social media comes in. And I'm here at these Women's World Championships, I mean, hoping that the exposure going out in the field, although I wasn't really wanting to be that exposed, but I said, this is an opportunity for the younger folks to put it out there on social media. And you're not going to make any progress if, in fact, the kids don't see. Show some positive role models, because seeing is believing.
Right.
And let's intentionally recruit students of diverse backgrounds. Intentionally recruit teachers of diverse backgrounds. I use my daughter as an example. The reason why Tracy is the head tennis coach at Harvard University is because she got a chance to hang around with me. And I never thought she would play tennis because we didn't have any tennis in our at that particular time. It was field hockey. But because of the National Youth Sports Program, a lot of the private schools had like Drexel and Penn, and they had programs like that because they wanted to reach out the community. So again, it's exposure. Sports like lacrosse, field hockey, and fencing have to be included on the agenda, and you know, make sure that public funds are used correctly for everybody.
When young people see you or see Natasha Watley or see the Williams sisters, and suddenly more young women of color want to pick up tennis rackets, and then sports take kids on to college. Through the sport, they're going to have more kids succeeding.
Right. If you have schools in Black communities, we need to upgrade the facilities so they're equitable to private schools, because there's a lot of inequities as far as facilities.
You know, this is interesting because Candace Story Lee, who, as you know, first Black woman to be the athletic director at Vanderbilt University, has said that a single policy like Title IX can't be expected to bring equity to the field, because really all it said again was, if you're spending the dollars on the boys, you have to spend the dollars on the girls. But she also said a law alone doesn't change behavior. You have to have people committed, as you're saying, at every level. I don't blame Title IX for that. We have work to do in our communities to ensure there's access. Take kids on field trips, let them see what's possible. And you're still fighting an uphill battle. There's a whole private industry of tutoring and teaching kids in sports with the goal of getting them, you know, into college. And I think the only way normal, regular communities can compete is with community programs.
I strongly agree with that. And again, I go back to public funds, you know. I mean, what are we using our dollars for? We're paying taxes. We have to really start examining and really being intentional about examining what's happening.
That's Tina Sloan Green, longtime Temple University lacrosse coach, founder of the Black Women in Sports Foundation, on what needs to happen beyond Title IX's gender mandates to bring equity to girls and women of color. And by the way, she mentioned Vivian Stringer. That would be C. Vivian Stringer, who holds one of the best coaching records in the history of women's basketball and was head coach at Rutgers until just this year, I think she retired. So a shout out there as well. Coach Sloan Green, Tina, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And, you know, step up and step out.
Okay, I will. So the State Department has concluded that Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was likely killed by gunfire from Israeli military positions, but this high-profile case is far from resolved. The U.S. says a ballistics test on a bullet given them by Palestinians came up inconclusive, and the journalist's family, which had urged the U.S. to get involved in this case, is unsatisfied. NPR's Daniel Estrin joins us from Tel Aviv. Daniel, tell us first what role the U.S. did play in investigating this case and more about what it concluded.
Well, the U.S. was the one that convinced the Palestinian officials to hand over the bullet that killed Abu Akleh. The bullet was and has been the focus of a dispute between Israelis and Palestinians over who shot her. U.S. officials observed while Israeli experts conducted the ballistic investigation of the bullet, and the U.S. concluded the bullet, which entered her head and hit her protective helmet, was too badly damaged to be able to match it to any weapon. But the U.S. said it did review official Israeli and Palestinian investigations of what happened that day, and based on those reviews, concluded that the gunfire likely came from Israeli soldiers' positions, but the U.S. says it has no reason to believe that it was intentional gunfire. And the U.S. did not say that it thought it was Palestinian gunmen, as Israel continues to say is a possibility.
So what happened here? Because, yes, this is a Palestinian-American journalist, but for weeks the State Department had been dismissing the idea of, you know, that, you know, they're conducting an investigation. So why did the State Department get involved?
There was a lot of pressure from Congress members to get involved. But also, speaking to activists and commentators here, they believe Biden's visit, President Biden's visit to the region next week, is playing a role because it appears the U.S. wants to really shelve this issue before his visit. Biden is going to Israel and Saudi Arabia. Killings of journalists have made headlines in both of those countries, Shirin Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank, Jamal Khashoggi, who the U.S. has concluded was killed by Saudi agents in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And so there's still an open question of how the Biden administration is holding these countries to account over the journalist killings. And so I spoke with some Israeli human rights activists who said they spoke with the U.S. ambassador here and that he believes Israel was responsible for killing Abu Akleh. He had hoped a ballistic test would prove that and lead to an Israeli apology. But here we are. It didn't.
Right. Well, and so how are Israelis and Palestinians reacting? Do they accept this conclusion from the U.S. that it was likely a bullet from the Israelis?
Well, Israel says it's still an open case. It says they're still investigating. It does not accept the U.S. conclusion. Palestinian officials are objecting to what the U.S. has said. They say there is a lot of evidence that you can get, not just from the bullet, but other evidence, as media outlets and the U.N. concluded in their own investigations. And when I spoke with Abu Akleh's family, they said they want the U.S. to continue to press Israel for accountability and justice.
And when do you think we might get, or will we get, more answers and more acceptance?
The State Department says it's going to be seeking answers, accountability, further steps. We don't know anything beyond that. This has major implications because the International Criminal Court right now is considering whether to charge Israel with war crimes. And so the question of Shirin Abu Akleh and whether Israel will investigate and hold anyone accountable plays a major factor in that question.
We'll continue to follow it with NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You may have seen fundraising ads to feed children in Somalia because it's bad there. I reported from that region during the famine of 2011 and held a baby boy who was 2 months old, 6 pounds. That famine killed about 250,000 people, half of them children. And now the warning signs are even worse, according to UNICEF. Sudarshan Raghavan at The Washington Post, our editorial partners, spent 3 days in Somali refugee camps, and he joins us. Sudarshan, welcome back.
Good to be back.
This is a complex story of climate and grain prices, war, terror groups. But can you start by putting a face to this famine? You wrote about several people in your latest article, one a child named Amina, a young mother named Habiba Mahmoud. Tell us about one or both.
Sure. Well, Amina really sticks out. I mean, I met her mother and her siblings in a camp in Dolo, Somalia, on the edge of the Ethiopian border. Amina was, and her family were fleeing drought and hunger. They hadn't eaten in about a week, and Amina was just too tired to walk. Their home was roughly about 40 miles away from Dolo, but they were already on their second day of fleeing their village. Her body was thin, her skin was flaking with severe malnutrition, her mother described to me, and she just collapsed and died. Mm. You know, her mother tried to revive her, and you know, she searched for a heartbeat, and finally, you know, she realized that, you know, her baby daughter was dead. And what was striking was that they're outside this village, and these villagers came. They buried her along with, you know, according to the Muslim rites. The villagers actually provided a white cloth to wrap Amina in, and that was it. Her mother and her siblings didn't really have time to mourn. They pretty much after the burial, they started walking. Her mother had 6 other children to save. They made it to the camp in Dolo after 2 more days of walking. And when they got there, I mean, there was barely any help for them. There was no aid agencies working there at the time. They had to rely on helpful people in the camp who themselves had fled drought and hunger to actually give them probably some meals. And when we spotted them, they were, you know, they had been there a day or so, and they had a day and a half actually, and they'd only eaten like a little bit of rice. So even at that point, even when they had reached the camp, they were still, you know, desperate and hungry.
Yeah. And there are, of course, so many factors as to why this is happening. The experts often say droughts are natural, but famines are man-made. Let's unpack the many reasons for this. One is, of course, drought. The rain has failed four seasons in a row, I gather. So then if I'm a farmer there, a Somali farmer, and there's no harvest, then I have to buy grain. And grain prices are sky high now, right?
That's correct. Somalia is no stranger to famine. In fact, the whole region of East Africa and the Horn have experienced famine and drought. And even in good times, food aid is needed for many people. But what's happening now is that, you know, you've had, as you mentioned, four consecutive failed rain seasons, and all made worse by climate change. You have an ongoing conflict happening there that's trapping hundreds of thousands of people, even within their villages. You know, the people we met in these camps, in some ways, are the more fortunate ones. They were actually able to get up and walk out. There are plenty of other places where people just cannot leave because they're either prohibited from leaving, thanks to Al-Shabaab, which is an Islamic militant group that's been fighting the government for more than a decade, or they simply can't because they're just too far away from these camps. It's too far to walk. There are no aid agencies going out to these areas. And of course, you have disease. The pandemic is also part of the issue here, as well as even locust infestations. But what is unique about what's happening in Somalia now is that this hunger crisis, hunger calamity, is caused by a war far, far away, 3,000 miles away, to be precise. That's the war in Ukraine. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, in many ways, is fueling starvation in Somalia. You know, Russia and Ukraine were among the world's top producers and exporters of grains. In fact, together, they nearly provided all of Somalia's wheat. The wars, of course, disrupted these supply chains. And what's also been affected is crude oil from Russia. And that has also contributed to, you know, the soaring costs for fuel, transportation, and food production. Bear in mind, these food prices have already been high because of the drought and the pandemic. But, you know, since the war began in Ukraine, since late February, early March, the prices have been skyrocketing even more so. I mean, I spoke to many traders in the markets, sellers, that is, who can literally pinpoint when the prices have doubled, even tripled in some areas, you know, and they point literally to March when they saw a sharp rise from prices that were already high to begin with.
Yeah, well, these prices are what they are, and there are different kinds of financial help for a family, I imagined, in years past. Perhaps their animals were their financial reserve. Many of those have died off because of this drought. Some of them have relatives overseas who can send money if they have jobs in the middle of this pandemic. But then, of course, there's the question of outside aid. In past famines, the U.S., the World Food Program, were blamed for being late with their help. What about the aid now?
It's sad to say it's a very similar situation. The aid is simply not reaching anyone. In fact, there's very little aid to begin with. In fact, you know, the United Nations made an appeal of $1.5 billion for help, to help Somalia and other parts of the region. And what they've received so far is only 18% from the world. And let's put this in comparison. Just last month, the United States alone, the U.S. Congress approved $7.5 billion in economic aid to help Ukraine. A top Somali drought official told me that he understands that, you know, the world is focused whenever there's any kind of geostrategical confrontation, mm-hmm. the world will focus on that. But he said that, you know, if the Ukraine crisis had not happened, wasn't around, I think the world would have been giving more funding, more aid to help the people of Somalia. That, to me, that was very striking. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, you were there in 2011, and I was actually just in Ukraine 3 weeks earlier before I visited Somalia.
Yeah.
And just to me, the difference in the world's reaction to what's happening in Somalia and what's happening in Ukraine could not have been more starkly contrasting for me. I mean, when I was in Ukraine, I met Ukrainians who were, you know, who had relatives who were all across Europe, who'd managed to flee and find homes and find support in so many ways. I mean, you know, you don't see starving Ukrainians in Ukraine or even outside. And when I saw what's happening in Somalia, it's heartbreaking. And you go to the hospitals, you go to the camps, you just see all these really sickly, skeletal babies, and you realize that it's tragic that the world cares so little about, you know, people from this part of the world when the response to another conflict, another tragedy, is so vastly different and so vastly helpful than in Somalia.
Sudarshan Raghavan is correspondent at large for the Washington Post, talking to us about his reporting in Somalia. Sudarshan, thank you as always. Thanks for your reporting.
My pleasure, Scott.
Massachusetts is the most expensive state for childcare in the country. Annual costs average $20,000, according to data from the Economic Policy Institute. And throughout the pandemic, the burden of paying for it has not only proven more difficult for working parents, it's a problem for employers struggling to find and keep employees. Yasmin Amer of member station WBUR tells us how some employers in Massachusetts are stepping up.
Where do you want to eat your breakfast? Do you want to eat in your playroom and we can read some books?
On a typical morning, Sarah Berkeley chops up strawberries and a bagel for her 2-year-old Cole.
Mama breakfast. Yeah, Mama.
She'll log on to work soon from the top floor of her home just outside of Boston. Berkeley is a manager for a benefits consultant called NFP. While she's at work, she relies on a nanny to care for Cole.
Look, you want to play the music?
It's a good arrangement. Berkeley feels lucky to have it, especially with another baby on the way. But on the few days things don't go as planned, because even nannies get sick, Berkeley falls back on a familiar option.
I can definitely turn the TV on and let him watch Elmo. It's really the only way I'll get some quiet time, because otherwise he's kind of just like, Mama, Mama, book?
Tiger,
yeah, you want to watch Daniel Tiger.
But she does have another option, something more employers like hers have started to offer. Backup child care. Her company offers 10 days of subsidized care. She says it can be hard to find someone last minute.
But the times that it works, it's great. It's been great. And it's been a savior for sure.
Anne Berkeley is seeing more of her own clients offering this benefit too. Bright Horizons is a Massachusetts-based company with child care centers across the world. Since the pandemic, they've seen a 28% increase in the number of U.S. business clients who've added backup care.
If you want to keep employees, you know, and if you want these working moms to stay, then you have to give them support. And that's just how it is.
Employers like J.C. Burton recognize this. She's the founder and CEO of Maven Construction in Boston. But there was this 10-month period right after the pandemic hit when she had another unofficial title.
The chief babysitter or chief childcare coordinator was a task and a job I didn't know that I would ever have.
Around half of Burton's staff had young kids who couldn't go to school, including her own 8-year-old daughter. So parents took turns watching a handful of kids.
We had to turn ourselves into a little temporary daycare, right? There were offices that we utilized where we had to, you know, set aside space for kids to kind of come and work while their parents were working.
Burton would call local childcare centers on behalf of her employees, and when spots opened up, she immediately paid the deposits to secure them. In fact, Burton now includes childcare in her plans for new construction projects.
So yes, in the project plan, we're certainly thinking about that now. We would not have ever previously thought about that.
There has been a major shift in the state's business community, says Tom Weber, who leads the Massachusetts Business Coalition for Early Childhood Education. The group of more than 80 business leaders launched last year.
I don't think that employers see it so much as their responsibility, as much as they see it as their enlightened self-interest to engage in solutioning around childcare because they desperately need workers.
One of the coalition members is Lori Meads, the CEO of Siemens Bank in Cape Cod. Her bank partners with local childcare centers and pays 65% of the tuition. They started doing it way before the pandemic.
We've been able to keep many an employee because of it. And, you know, the cost that you would spend on time and resources to train someone, it is far more beneficial to help them in this way and be able to keep them in the workforce.
Now, it's unusual to find any employer who pays that much for childcare. And it's very unusual to find employers in the service sector that provide any childcare support, even though service workers struggle with some of the least flexible schedules. Lamia Elithwi has been working as a housekeeper at a Boston hotel for nearly 3 years, making a union wage of $26 per hour. Without childcare benefits from her employer, it's difficult to afford full-time care for her two young children.
I was thinking right now about, like, quit my job because I don't have choice. But at the same time, if I quit, we cannot pay our bills.
When employees leave jobs or reduce their hours, it can have economic consequences for their families and for their employers who have to recruit and train new workers. But Tom Weber says there's more momentum than ever from employers. They want to solve this problem. What they don't want to do is foot that massive childcare bill on their own. So the coalition is putting its weight behind state legislation that would put way more money into childcare.
I think that this, you know, is best solved through public-private partnership. Certainly, it's not going to be achievable by continuing to place it on the shoulders of families alone.
The Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation estimates that inadequate childcare costs employers in the state more than $800 million a year. Workers lose more than twice that in wages, especially women. That's a huge motivator for J.C. Burton, the owner of Maven Construction.
Right. If our workforce is ever going to be equitable, where there are women involved, where there are people of color involved, we have to think about what that looks like for childcare and having access to childcare.
After all, she says, the future of her company depends on working parents. For Here and Now, I'm Yasmeen Ammer.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.